Hi, my name is Nijay Gupta. I serve as Professor of New Testament at Northern Seminary in Chicago.
Dr. Nijay Gupta. Nijay, great to see you, my friend.
Hi, David. Good to see you again.
I know it's been a little while since we've had a chat over this microphone and over Zoom, but I'm glad to see you. And hopefully you're going to be in San Antonio this year for SBL, and maybe we can get together and say hello.
Yep.
Yeah, you've been with us before on two podcasts. One, Paul in the Language of Faith, which is back in 2020.
Yep.
In 2022, we talked about your book, 15 New Testament Words. That was really terrific. And so this time we're going to be together. We are talking about another book that you've written. Man, you're writing a lot of books. Called Tell Her Story. And here's the subtitle. Love the subtitle. How Women Led, Taught, and Ministered in the Early Church. And is published by IVP Academic. First of all, congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, sometimes books you write are just sort of part of your profession, like a commentary. And some of them are like passion projects where you get to write on something you're really excited about topically or something related to personal life. This is one of those books where, you know, it touches kind of my passions and interests in ministry, and my wife is in ministry. So just exciting that a book like this is getting some interest and starting some discussions.
So you've actually come to this position, you're thinking about this over a number of years. Talk a little bit about that journey for you. How did it happen?
I grew up in Ohio, you know, the heartland. And the church that I was a part of as a young person was a conservative Brethren church. You know, men were the pastors and elders, and women often played supporting roles. And I didn't think anything of it. I was a convert from Hinduism, and I just kind of assumed the Bible talks about this. It's just the way it is. Nobody seemed upset about it. Nobody was protesting it. Went to college, got involved in some campus ministries, similar scenario where women are in more supportive roles, men are kind of up front with the microphone. And it really wasn't until seminary that I started to rethink some things. When I started to encounter students from a variety of different denominations, I didn't even know they existed, from Pentecostal denominations or Lutheran, Presbyterian, Episcopal. And I started to meet women studying for ministry, couples that are in ministry together. And I really started to wonder, you know, okay, where do they look in the Bible for supporting their own view? I'll tell you kind of a funny part of my story is I was very conservative Presbyterian when I started seminary. I was a big fan of John Piper and Wayne Grudem and Tim Keller. And so I actually wrote my first systematic theology paper on why women shouldn't be pastors.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow. Okay.
And I don't know why I chose that subject. I think that maybe I was trying to prove my credentials for that club, you know, what eventually became the Gospel Coalition. I don't know why, but I did. And then I started to meet these women in the MDiv program. I started to meet these women. They had the same beliefs I did. They had trusted scripture. They had a high view of inspiration and inerrancy and all those things. And I had to start rethinking things because I was taught these women are liberal. They're putting culture before God, you know, all this stuff. And they weren't. And I had professors that were supportive of women in ministry. And I thought, gosh, if these professors know the Bible through and through, where did they get this from? So I did about a year and a half deep study. I met my wife around that time. She was a seminary student. We started to think through and study things together. And I read Gordon Fee and Ben Witherington. And I remember reading F.F. Bruce. And I remember thinking, if Walt Kaiser, Gordon Fee, Ben Witherington, Craig Keener, Linda Belleville, if these very conservative, very pious scholars can support women ministry, then it's not really a conservative liberal issue. Because I was always afraid I would fall into this pit of liberal and just not be able to find my way out.
Yeah, yeah.
And to meet these scholars who I, you know, of the highest level of respect, like Ben Witherington was kind of one of my heroes. back then and just to see the stuff he'd written. So I ended up writing my final systematic theology paper on why women must be pastors. And I changed my mind.
A little bit of an evolution and development there.
A little evolution there.
Yeah.
I got an A on that paper, by the way, David, just so you
know. Good, 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 good. I'll give you an A on the book, too, as well. How about that?
Thank you. I'll tell you, you know, people ask, like, what was it that changed your mind? It wasn't any one thing. It was more that complementarianism, or a view that prohibits women from being pastors or lead pastors or elders, that view, I call it an edifice. Kind of think of it like a Jenga block of tower of blocks.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening is, as I read these scholars like R.T. France and Walt Kaiser, a piece comes out that I thought was a really solid piece of that building. So for example, let's take the example of primogeniture, privilege of the firstborn. Mm-hmm. So I kept hearing this argument when I was a teenager, Adam was made first, and that gives him priority. We call this primogeniture. But then I think R.T. France pointed out, God has a pattern of purposely not choosing the first.
That's
whether
right.
It's yeah. Isaac over Ishmael, Jacob over Esau, Joseph, King David, right? There's this pattern where God's going to do the opposite of what you expect, because it's about his glory and not our privilege. And so that started to erode. This idea that, okay, the disciples were men, the kings were men, but then you have Deborah, who is a very pious, successful, righteous leader in one of Israel's darkest times.
One of your earlier chapters, and it's a great chapter, by the way.
So these things start to raise questions. Romans 16 and all these women who are in ministry, Phoebe and Junia and Tryphena and Tryphosa and Mary of Rome and Persis and the sister of Nereus, the mother of Rufus, you know, all these people. And so what ends up happening is it starts to pull blocks out of that Jenga tower. And you start to realize this complementarian edifice is getting really rickety. And then you add to that personal experience of women who are filled with the Spirit, who are gifted in leadership, like my wife or like many of my students. And you start to think, why would we stop women from doing this? Because I think the old line is women are gullible, women are easily deceived, women are better at nurturing, they aren't as intelligent. And my own experience is that just isn't proven true. You know, for a long time, my boss was a woman and she was an excellent scholar, leader.
Yeah, some of my best students over the years, probably yours too, have been women, right? I mean, in terms of sheer intelligence, some of that really is left over all the way from going back to Aristotle. I actually spoke on the Household Codes here last past Sunday. And Aristotle makes the statement, and this is true across the ancient world, that women were considered somehow defective, you know, inferior.
Right.
They're defective men, you know. If they could be good, they could be completely whole, they would be men and they wouldn't be women. So, I mean, if that's the way, and that's the world into which Paul is speaking, right? And I think that's a part of what we have to keep in mind. And you help us keep in mind that through the book. A lot of your negotiation in the book is negotiating through Paul.
Well, one of the taglines of my book is we spend a lot of time talking about what women can and can't do. But when we look at the New Testament, we look at early Christianity, women were everywhere doing virtually everything. And so let me give you just a little bit of backdrop and then just one example, and we can just take that as a springboard.
Sure.
But people ask me why, if I finished seminary in 2006, why did it take me almost 20 years to write this book? And part of it, I was just getting my career going and still learning. But I think a big catalyst was that famous cultural moment in 2019 when John MacArthur said about Beth Moore, "Go home." If you're listening, you don't know about this. MacArthur was at a conference and someone asked him, what are two words that come to mind when you hear the word Beth Moore? Beth Moore is a popular Christian teacher, Bible teacher. And MacArthur said, go home. And you could take all kinds of connotations about that. But the idea that she's causing trouble for Southern Baptists, she needs to be quiet, she needs to focus on her home, however you take that. But what I realized as I'm studying Paul is women are often found outside the home.
Absolutely.
For example, Yodi and Syntyche are two Philippian Christian women who Paul says, contend with me side by side for the gospel, which is language of fighting in war. So whatever they're doing, they're not sitting around baking cookies. Not that there's anything wrong with that. And they're not
cookies,
folding laundry. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Right.
But they're out doing what we think of as front lines ministry. But just to give a quick example, one of the people that I give some time to talk about is a woman named Nympha. And I almost named her the most important Christian you've never heard of, because she is in somewhere in the Lycus Valley, modern day Turkey, Syria. And she is what we think of as an independent female leader of a house church, because Paul talks about Nympha and the church that meets in her home. And I used to think, oh, if you're a host, you're just sort of unlocking the door, leaving some snacks and lemonade out, and you're disappearing. Kind of like if you're hosting a Young Life meeting. But in the ancient world, that wouldn't be true. If you're the host, a host is a big deal.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And think about what Jesus says to the people that host him poorly. He said, you should have kissed my feet. You should have anointed me with oil. Hosts have a big responsibility, and often in terms of leadership, because they're kind of like a small business CEO versus just someone that happens to own a house. And so the Nymphas or the Aphias, who's partnering with Philemon, or the Priscilla and Aquila, you have these women that seem to be heavily involved in ministry. And it's hard then to say today, hey, no, you can't preach, you can't do these things. And so I really wanted to shine a spotlight on the named women leaders of the early church that most of us have never even heard their names before.
Yeah. What difference do you think it would make if pastors, church leaders, began talking about these women? In other words, celebrating their stories, doing what your book does, telling the story. You're able to go through a number of these, but there's still many, many more. So what difference would it make, you think, for the church if that began to happen?
Yeah, you know, I get this question a lot because people ask, what is a church missing when it doesn't have a female preacher or teacher or leader or pastor? And I think about it this way, David. If a church, let's say, has one pastor, whoever that pastor is, young or old, Indian, European, whatever it is, the congregation tends to associate God with their pastor in terms of personality, voice. It's just natural that you're going to experience God through your pastor. They become, you know, this is where we get the word vicar from, right? Vicarious. They become an agent of God.
Right.
You know, kind of like a priest. So if it's just a male voice that people are hearing, just naturally they're going to associate God with being male. If it's just an older person's voice or just a particular accent, they're going to associate God with that. And we must remember that God is neither male or female, right? God has motherly qualities and fatherly qualities. And just as Paul talks about his own apostleship in those ways. So I think what we're often missing is we end up with a one-dimensional understanding of God. And I think we're missing the fact that women can exercise amazing gifts in the church for our benefit. Let's just give an example of preaching. There's just a rule that a preacher tends to preach to themselves, especially an immature preacher. So I tend to preach to the vices of my own personality. So I struggle maybe with insecurity, or I struggle with shame, and I'll end up preaching a lot of sermons that have the same punchline that reflects the ways I want to grow as a Christian. But there are so many different kinds of Christians in the audience or in the congregation.
Interesting, yeah.
And so it takes different personalities, male and female, teaching, leading, preaching, to be able to give the full gospel to the whole people of God. We're really just delivering half the gospel if we just limit ourselves in that way.
Yeah, really, really interesting. I'm in such agreement with so much of what you're saying and the concerns that I have for the church at this point. Some of the people that you talk about in the book, I mean, you have whole chapters dedicated to, for example, Phoebe and Prisca and Junia. A lot of times people think of Junia particularly as a male. You know, some of the earlier translations, they have that. So when did that sort of revelation kick into you that, okay, Junia is not a guy, but Junia is a woman?
If I'm being perfectly honest, before seminary, I probably never read Romans 16, where Junia's mentioned.
It's and one of even those in chapters seminary, you sort of, you just jump
kinda,
over that.
It's right? kind of end credits. It feels like the end credits of a movie and you don't really pay attention. You know, there was a series of lectures that Beverly Gaventa gave there on YouTube, and she gave a lecture on the women of Romans 16. And I remember watching those lectures probably 10 years ago and just profoundly transformed in my understanding of the contributions of early Christian women from those lectures. So I'd say I trace it to her. I would not have known that Junias with an S is a male name and Junia with an A is a female name, but that is how it works when we look at the English translations. I thought you were going to ask, why is there differences in translations? And you know this because you work directly with Bible translations.
Sure, yeah.
But, you know, I'm going to give you the short version of the story. The Greek text, it's genuinely unclear what, you know, biological gender the person is that's named there. But Junia is a widely known name from that time, and Junias isn't. Now, Junias is hypothetically a short version of the male name Junianus, but even Junianus is not a name from that time. It's just a speculation. And so Junia makes a lot of sense that her name is Junia. It could be a husband-wife situation, Andronicus and Junia. But here's what's interesting. There's a scholar named Eldon Epp who studied biblical manuscripts. That was his expertise. And he was able to trace that Junia was widely known as this person in Rome throughout the patristic period, which is like 3rd century, 4th century, 5th century, 6th century, and really sometime probably in the 12th or 13th century, there was a tendency in the manuscript tradition to prefer transitioning it to a male name. It wasn't absolute, but there was a kind of preference that sort of became dominant because she is referred to as an apostle. And there are probably some scribes or theologians that thought that's not possible, so this must be a man. And it really wasn't until the 1970s and 80s with Bernadette Bruton and Eldon Epp that there was this kind of full recovery of the female identity of this woman, Junia, who's pretty amazing because she was not only an apostle, and she might have even walked as one of the disciples of Jesus. Some patristic writers speculate that she was part of the 70 that were sent out by Jesus himself in Luke 10, but she also shared prison time either with Paul or around the same time as Paul. And here's what's interesting, David, that I learned that I don't find in a lot of other books on the subject. Women rarely went to prison, and they only went to prison for high crimes. You don't go to prison for stealing a loaf of bread, for shoplifting. You go to prison for crimes that are considered direct threat to the Roman order. So Junia is doing something pretty bad in the eyes of Rome to get thrown in prison. And even the term that Paul uses isn't his normal term for going to prison, which is desmios, which means to be in chains. He uses one of my favorite Greek words, syn aichmalotas, which means fellow prisoner of war, which means she's being thrown into a serious incarceration situation. Now, he is using it as a metaphor because they weren't actually in war with Rome. But it's this idea that she's doing what we call hard time. And David, you know this from studying Paul. It's probably the highest mark of a Christian in Paul's book to do hard time, to be in chains for Jesus Christ. He only says that about a few people, Aristarchus, a couple other people, Epaphras. There are only three, I think, people that he says have done hard time. Andronicus and Junia, a couple other people. This is the greatest mark. In fact, John Chrysostom says, blessed be the chains. He wants to kiss the chains. Better to have the chains on your hands than have the power of healing in your hands.
What a great orator.
Yes, he was. Yeah. Golden-tongued.
Yes. Well, one of the things I didn't know, I had looked through Romans 16 a number of times, found a lot of women's names. I didn't know that 10 out of 26 were women's names. I thought that's pretty remarkable when you think about the kind of world into which early Christianity comes, right? It's not a matriarchal world. It's not really a world of equality. It's a world where it's fairly strong, at least in the public sphere, dominated by men.
You know, what's amazing is I could not find another list in the whole Roman world of 9 women in one place with only positive things said about them. Now, you might have like a census, you might have like a family tree, but nothing like this where it's it's not just a list of names. He's commending these people. I called an honor roll. You know, he's saying, this is the best of us. I was just at my son's eighth grade graduation, and they give out awards. You know, why do we give out awards? We're saying they're doing the kinds of behaviors that we think are the virtues and models that we should all emulate. That's why we give out these awards, right? And this is what Paul's doing. He's doing this. And I heard something really interesting from a scholar named Andrew Clark. He makes the argument that Paul is putting flesh onto his statement in Galatians, neither male nor female, Jew nor Gentile, slave or free, because in that list of about 30 people in Romans 16, Paul intentionally names Jewish names and non-Jewish names, like Herodian is a Jewish name, but a lot of the names in there are not Jewish names. Slave or free, some of the names are slave names like Urbanus, Ampliatus, because they're descriptive names. And some of the names probably are names of elites in that list. Phoebe is probably on the wealthier end. And what's interesting, David, is in most of Paul's letters, and you know this, he rarely names people at the end. And when he does, it may be one or two people. So to name almost 30 people is certainly intentional.
Yeah.
And all the commendations in there, which they would already know. Epaphras is the first Christian convert in Asia. He's not telling them things they don't know. He's commending them. And Luke Timothy Johnson pointed this out. If you put your thumb over all those names, based on the commendations, you wouldn't know whether they're male or female. And that's unusual in the Roman world. In the Roman world, you would have a tendency to genderize the commendation. Women are sweet, faithful, good caretakers of the family, and men are rough and tough and brave and strong. And he doesn't do that. All of them get the same commendation. This is what they are. They toil for the gospel and they work hard for the Lord. That's the most common commendation, whether male or female. And I think that's helpful as we think about what ministry should look like.
This has been a terrific book and a great conversation, Dr. Nijay Gupta. We're talking about his book, Tell Her Story, How Women Led, Taught, and Ministered in the Early Church. I really recommend the book. You got to think about it. You got to ponder it, read through these stories. Let those stories inform you about them. Dr. Nijay Gupta, thanks for being with us today on The Stone Chapel.
My pleasure.
You know, it's always good to talk to Dr. Nijay Gupta. We're going to put information in the show notes about his earlier podcast, so be sure to check those out because they're always good. You know, one of the things we didn't talk about in the podcast was the fact that he concludes the book by talking about those passages in Paul's letters that are often used to limit women in ministry. And so what about Paul prohibiting women from teaching in the church? That's a kind of an appendix to the book. And then he also says, what about the submission text in New Testament household codes? He tackles both of those. Now, you may not agree with all of his conclusions, but I mean, it is definitely worth considering. Hey, thanks to all of our production people who make this podcast possible. If you have not signed on and are subscribed to this podcast, go ahead and do that because we bring great content every week. Some of the best scholars in the world are part of these conversations. And don't forget the nugget of wisdom that's coming up a little bit later on. Thanks to Phil Keggy for the music. Thanks to Kathy Capes for all of her great editing of this podcast. We will see you next time.
One of the earliest titles for Christians was Christianoi, because it was kind of a misunderstanding of the word Christian. And Christianoi comes from even a common slave name, which means useful, but it could also mean good. And Christians actually came to embrace that mispronunciation. So what we learn from that is Christian people were supposed to be kind people. So go and be kind.